Welcome to another episode of Roll or Die. We've got one for the fans today. We've got an OG that goes way back. Some of our younger listeners may not know this name, but I'm pretty sure all of the old school guys will know him. He's an OG from way back, started jiu-jitsu back in the 90s. We've actually learned he's actually one of my old teammates. He's the head coach of Start Jiu-Jitsu in Launceston. He is a fourth degree black belt. He's been around forever and a day. We are looking forward to getting to hear some of these stories that he's going to tell us. He is Damus Fry. Thanks for joining us, Damus.
Thanks very much for having me, Kim and Anton. Great awesome, to be here.
Damus. So Damus, I've never even heard the name Damus in my entire life. Is there an origin story to that name? Or did your parents make it up? Were they like, nah?
My mother made my name up, basically, oh, yes. But it's a play on Seamus, I think, you know. So it's got an Irish history Irish
I reckon it's origin. Like you're like a knight or something, like a medieval name. It sounds very, very regal.
Damien, yeah. So Damus of Launceston.
Yes. Yeah. So, like I was saying, I think we were old teammates. You were telling us before we started recording that you started jiu-jitsu with Dabeen, Peter Dabeen. Can you tell us how you got started in jiu-jitsu?
Okay, so look, I started jiu-jitsu. I'm 47 now. Started when I was 19. Originally, I was just a teenager, big fan of martial arts generally. So when I was 14 or so, I had a part-time job. I lived and grew up in Cairns, so right up the top. So far from Queensland boy, born and bred, and I had a part-time job, and most of the time, I would spend my weekends going down to the local news agency and flicking through a lot of the older black belt magazines and things like that, and very early on, I would say 1991, I started seeing the little Gracie jiu-jitsu ads, and just the way those ads were written, I guess, back in the day, it always just fascinated me as to what that was. And of course, this was all pre-internet days and things like that, so it was just something that stuck in the back of my mind. So ultimately, I finished school in 1994, it took my first training trip away to have a look at jiu-jitsu effectively live, because I had no VHS. I'd never actually seen it practiced live up until my first training trip, and that was April 1997.
Wow.
So you came on a holiday specifically. You came to Melbourne. Is that what happened?
Came to Melbourne. That's right. Yeah, I'd done a little bit of research in the background, and I'd found out at that stage that there was only two guys at that point that were doing jiu-jitsu in Australia that had any sort of experience with it. And that was, of course, John Will and Peter Dabeen. And perfectly, I guess, for me, they were effectively only located probably within sort of half an hour of each other. Of course, John being in Geelong and Peter being based down at that stage in Torquay. Yeah. So that was it. So they were both brown belts at the time. Yeah. So there was no black belts in Australia that I was aware of. So I took the opportunity and ran with it. Yeah, ran with it. It was brilliant.
You're the second person, I think, and it was John Will. He mentioned Black Belt magazine once, and I've just Googled. Like, I remember this magazine. Are they still making Black Belt magazine? I don't think so. But back then, I do remember. Yeah. It was the go-to source of information. And yes. I think you're the second to jiu-jitsu through Black Belt magazine. That we were at. Is that true, Kim? Do you remember that? Do you remember John Will talking about that?
Yeah, I reckon. Yeah.
And what attracted you? Sorry, I missed that because I kind of went down. I went down this rabbit hole a little bit. But like, what actually stood out to you about the ground game? How did it? How did it? How did it?
Well,
you?
Well, I would say what really captured me with it was, I think, the way those ads were worded. I mean, at the time, it was very early on. So the Gracies used to advertise in these magazines that, you know, they were undefeated in street condition matches. And at that stage, their thing was, you know, we've been undefeated for 65 years. I also happened to see the early Playboy magazine article that was by Horry and Gracie, of course. So
the article was
Yeah. So I actually did see that article as well, and I found that just fascinating reading. Yeah, because, you know.
So that was quite
a notorious article.
Are you serious? Jiu-Jitsu was advertised in Playboy.
Yeah, absolutely.
No way.
Yeah, Horry and Gracie had probably, that was probably one of, even before some of his early interviews in some of the American, US sort of magazines, he had a huge, cover in, cover type story in Blitz. And this is, sorry, not in Blitz, in Playboy. And this was, this was around the
now
time.
Now Anton's going to Google that.
I'm pretty sure this was all sort of quite concurrent with when Hoist Gracie was sort of trying to challenge Mike Tyson to a match back at that stage. So yeah, that was getting a little bit of coverage.
While Anton goes down that rabbit hole, I'll ask you. So you came to Geelong and Torquay, and you had what, a couple of classes with him, and then what?
So basically, I did about a week training with John Will, and then I ended up, and that was April 1997. I went back to Cairns, and at that stage, I had a small sort of club. My original martial arts background was Wing Chun and a little bit of sort of kickboxing stuff. But I'm quite a small statured person, so I'm about 5'7". I've always been around the 65 to 70 kilo mark. And that was a thing with a lot of these early ads with the Gracie guys. They were all quite small guys, and they seemed to be able to do quite well in that grappling room. So I've done my week's training in April 97. For whatever reason, I can't quite remember now, but I didn't actually get the opportunity to train with Peter on that first trip. My intention in that original trip was to train with both John and Pete. But I went home, I think a couple of months later, I rung Peter and spoke to him on the phone. And he said to me, well, it's good timing. Henzo Gracie was going to come to Australia in November 97. So I just took the opportunity at that point to go down. And Henzo, I think, was in Australia for 2 weeks at that point. And the first week he ran seminars on one weekend, and the following weekend was the Australian Championships. Mm-hmm. And I competed in that. That was actually my first jiu-jitsu competition in November 97. And Henzo reffed a couple of my matches. So for me, it was a real fanboy moment. You know, it was great. And I think that's probably largely how I ended up, you know, staying with Pete and training under him.
Wait, hang on, just go back a step. So, but you'd gone there in April, had a less than a week of work with John Will, and then came back in November and competed. So what did you do in the meantime? Did you recruit like a group of people to try and learn this thing with you, and you just figured it out off this 1 week of jiu-jitsu that you'd got under your belt? Yeah.
That was it. Yeah. That was exactly it. I took a week of classes, and what I would give, I would say, even at that stage, you know, that week of classes, John was a very succinct in terms of his ability to package things really well and convey a lot of information in a short amount of time. So I guess for me, it was something that conceptually a lot of it gelled in my mind. Of course, I just needed the opportunity to practice in a physical setting. I went home. I had a group of guys around me at that stage, and we trained. And, of course, as I said, I had a kickboxing background and sort of kung fu background, and I was doing that 4 days a week, one day of jiu-jitsu, then it became 2 days of jiu-jitsu, and all of a sudden it just took over within a space of a month. So then I put in about 5 months, I think, pretty solid, just, you know, 6 days a week we were training jiu-jitsu.
Did you have any feedback from anyone in that time, like, or you were just kind of in a way flying blind almost, like
flying blind, very much.
Going, well, let's just keep going with this or whatever and progressing as you could, or?
Yes, yeah, that was exactly it. Yeah, that was exactly it. And so I just effectively just, I was, yeah, living on love, I guess, in a lot of ways. I loved it as an art and as a concept.
Yeah.
And the guys around me as well at the same time sort of, you know, we all fell into it together. And it was great. It was just a real, John and Peter both, I guess, gave me one important bit of feedback, I guess, ultimately when I'm brought up with Pete, but I'd heard it up from John as well very early on. And it was basically to say that, you know, don't take whatever you learn and go back and then just try and show people part of it. You've got to show everyone everything that you know, and you've got to be showing. And early on, the whole thing was to show people how to beat you, because of course you were the one coming back showing someone something. You know, so the whole thing was to try and, you know, that whole you know, a rising tide lifts all boats kind of thing. So it was all about just trying to, you know, upskill together and lift each other. And we did quite well. We did quite well under that format. There it is.
I found that's the article. It. This is it. Orion Gracie is willing to fight to the death, bad, to prove he's the toughest man in the West. And scrolling down, some people do actually read Playboy for the articles. Is this the article? Is this the one?
That's the article. Amazing. That is the one.
And it, this,
of
this
course, I don't remember how I happened to come across a Playboy magazine at, you know, 14 years of age or something. But you know, there it is. So,
wow, amazing! I'm keen to read this, but it's too close to, you know, my eyesight. My 50-year-old eyesight's not going to cut that after Zoom in later. But the other thing is, like, I'm keen to know about John Will and Peter Debien and all these guys. Like, are they the same guys now as they were then, or have they changed significantly? Like, were they complete meatheads? Like, because John Will's quite articulate in his more senior years, but, you know, was he just a smash-em, a rock-em, sock-em robot back then? It was like,
Look, my early experience with John, I guess, you know, in fairness, I would have to honestly say I found him to be a very good instructor. He was very much across, like, I think he knew his mission. He was a good coach, and he was here in Australia and in Geelong, of course, you know, just, you know, building people in the way that he does.
I remember
I was actually having a private class with him one day at his school there, and I was on the mat with him, and he got a phone call from Hege Machado on the academy phone. And I remember it because I was there in April 97, and it was his 40th birthday.
Okay.
So there you go. So, so 97. So there you go. So John was always a very, very good coach. And then, you know, he was very structured in the way he did things. Peter was you know, equally effective, but a lot less structured. Peter, even very early on, like, it's interesting now that there's a lot of talk in the coaching community about, you know, live practice and ecological coaching methods and things. And I think very early on, where Pete didn't, I guess, he didn't have the same structure as John. A lot of what Peter was doing very early on was a lot of, you know, very nuanced positional training. So a lot of the work we did coming through with Peter was live. And it was just, I thought, a very, very fast way of building your skills. So I took that methodology.
Peter Debien was the Kit Dale of his time. That's what I heard just then.
In a lot of ways he was. You know, my early classes with Pete, as an example, we'd come in and Pete would start the class with problem solving. So he would often have a group there, and he would say, who's having problems from any given position? And someone would just say, well, I'm having trouble escaping from here, or having trouble getting out of an arm lock, or having trouble finishing from a certain position. And we would just start to build things out from there. And it was a different approach, but it was great, you know. And it certainly gave me a means to be able to head back to Cairns and just continue doing what I was trying to do there, which was to, you know, to build a school and try and, I guess, build a presence of jiu-jitsu in far north Queensland. because early on there was only, you know, especially outside of Victoria, there weren't heaps of people around doing it, you know. So it was a great time.
I would say you might actually be one of the first people in Australia that got your blue belt. Would that be pretty accurate?
I think probably through Peter's. I don't know in terms of John's guys, but certainly in terms of Pete's guys, yes. Yeah. I got my blue belt actually in Brazil at Gracie Barra.
Yeah.
So when I started with Pete, as I say, I was there in November 97. That was my first trip to train with Peter. Mm-hmm. And obviously I met Henzo at that stage. And the following July 98, I went to Brazil and competed in the third world championship.
Hmm.
Which was great. I got my blue belt 2 days before, because there was no white belt division then. You couldn't compete as a white belt. You had to be blue or above. So, 2 days before the Mundial, I got my blue belt and had a crack at it.
So you had really only been doing jiu-jitsu for just over a year, like not even a year and a half, and really doing it pretty much on your own, I would say, based on what you've said. That's phenomenal when you think about it, especially when you compare to today's generation of jiu-jitsu today. You can look anywhere, you know, go on the internet, you can find anything at all, and you've done it pretty much off your own bat. Like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was an interesting time, because I think, of course, pre-internet, if you wanted to learn a cool new technique, you'd have to look at a magazine, so they'd have those series of stills, still photos that they put in a progression. Occasionally they'd throw you a curveball when the photos were out of sequence or something, and you'd be like, how does that work?
I've got those books, Jiu-Jitsu University, opening the closed guard. I've got all those books
just
still.
Like, hold on a minute, am I missing something here?
I've still got some little tabs where I've like marked them, like trying to remember stuff now. People are so spoiled. They can just straight away on the internet, within 5 seconds, you've got the answer. So, it's fantastic to hear that the way it happened for you. So, so you were over in Brazil. Was that your only trip to Brazil? Or
no, I went over twice. I went to Brazil twice. So first time was about, I think it was about 5 weeks, in July 98. That was great. Did the world championship there. But the whole thing really was about, for me, even early on, I was very, very interested in watching the training. And I had the opportunity to go in, because Gracie Barra at that time was an absolute powerhouse. And Carlos Gracie Jr. was based there in Rio, and he was there most classes. July 98, of course, that was cool. You know, I was seeing a lot of Machado brothers were coming back there. A lot of their students were back there. So everyone was converging on Rio, of course, for the world championship. So I used to go back in and watch the black belt training sessions where they were preparing for worlds, and watching their drilling and what they were doing specifically. And of course, I just took that back, you know, when I got back to Cairns, I just took that back into our training and just tried to almost just mimic it. So that was my approach early on. I was just trying to adopt the best practices I could find. Mm-hmm. And because I'd said to Pete too, as a side note, you know, I think I should relocate to Melbourne. And he said, you don't have to do that at all. You just have to, you know, come down periodically, or make sure, looking at your training, that you're not getting off track and going down, you know, rabbit holes, I guess, that you don't need to be. As long as you're progressing in a holistic way, then just stay where you are and do what you're doing. But so July 98, then I went again, Kim, in July 2001 for my second trip. Unfortunately though, that trip was cut short for me. My mother at that stage, so I was 24 and my mother was, she just turned 50, and she actually had a massive heart attack while I was in Brazil. So I had to leave pretty early and head back. And unfortunately she passed away before I got back home. So
sorry.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was just one of those things, but it was, so it should have been, that second trip should have been a much longer trip, and I was going to try and immerse myself a lot more, but unfortunately, it just didn't happen.
Mm. Yeah. And then you went a third time again. When was that?
No, I didn't go a third. That was it. That was it.
That was
so
it,
98, 98, 2001. But outside of that, in terms of my training here in Australia, I was traveling probably four times a year between Cairns and Melbourne.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and
that's a lot of commitment. I thought for some reason we'd missed each other when you were in Melbourne. I didn't realize that you were never really based in Melbourne. You only came and went.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
That's some
that's right.
dedication. Jeez.
I just loved it, and but it was an interesting thing too, I guess. Going back to Melbourne all the time, I was training partially in Melbourne and part of my time in Torquay as well. And there was a group of early guys, Ivan Rakitic, Lance Dartnell, Daniel Cherubin,
Lance, when are you
which
coming on this podcast, mate? I'm trying all avenues here. I'm getting nothing. Sorry, sorry to interrupt. I've got to call him
no.
out because he's keep promising and I'm only hearing crickets. Sorry, sorry, go on.
Tumbleweed.
But those guys, and as I say, Daniel Cherubin as well was one of the big ones. Another guy, he's very, very quiet these days, but he's always had brilliant jiu-jitsu. Smaller guy, fellow named Darren McKean.
All right, I'm going to hit him up next. All right.
Darren McKean,
Hopefully.
so he's in Brisbane. He was fantastic. Michael Wilson, so there was that group of guys. I mean, for me, it was an interesting thing because I could train with my group of guys in Cairns. I would find, just before my next trip to Melbourne, they'd be either, with me or possibly even over the top of me in terms of training. Because I was still, even though I was the one going away and coming back, I was the smallest guy on the mat. So for me, it was always a tough ask, like especially as the guys around me got better and better. I'd go to Melbourne, and if I was in Melbourne for 2 weeks, I would honestly just get smashed for 2 weeks, in the most loving way possible. But it was just tough. But the irony I used to find in that was I could be completely on the receiving end for 2 weeks. I'd head back to Cairns, and then I'd train with the guys I was only just training with 2 weeks prior, and
That's
my
right.
training would have taken this almighty jump. Extraordinary.
How do you get that jump nowadays? Like, where do you go for your knowledge? What's your secret sauce?
Well, I don't know so much if I've got a secret sauce. I guess obviously now I'm, I love content. I do love the fact that content's so easily available. I think, if I'm honest, I think, I focus a lot, in terms of that content, I focus a lot on what John Danaher is doing. I think most people do. I think it's a bit of a best practice type of thing. The one thing though, I guess for me too, is that given that I've been, doing jiu-jitsu for as long as I have, I do, I've met a lot of people over those years. So I have a good network, generally speaking. So one guy I've sort of been dealing with a little bit in recent times, and he was only just at my gym 6 weeks ago, was John Donahue. So John, I find also another really interesting character, given that, he's very accomplished with jiu-jitsu, but he's got a really, really deep understanding of catch wrestling as well, and given his background with Gene LaBelle. And so he's got a very broad approach to grappling. And as well, he's very well connected in terms of, just wrestling out of the US as well, freestyle, and he's got a lot of connections through the Midwest and Iowa and places like that. So I've found him to be very a great, a good mentor for me as well, and someone I'm going to certainly work with a lot more. Of course, and I, Rafael Lima or Gordinho was one of the guys out of Gracie Barra in the 90s. He won the world championship there in 98, the first year I went. Gordinho's been absolutely massive in my development. He was a good friend of Peter's, so I've known Gordinho forever, really, and he's been an incredible mentor for me as well. So so I guess in terms of content, I like to look at the latest content. I'm big on best practice, and I like to try and optimize our approach to training. I think that's really, really big as well. But I'd probably say if I'm honest, that is the probably my biggest focus at the moment in jiu-jitsu is optimizing practice, getting the best bang for the buck, so to speak,
Love it.
and trying to upskill as quickly as possible.
Brilliant.
Tasmania is an interesting place, in that we haven't had a really well-established competition scene down here. Whereas of course up in Melbourne and Sydney, you can compete every other weekend. So it's fortunate this year there's been a round robin style competition that's been established here. But I'm, you know, as a personal sort of project, I'm trying at the moment to work toward bringing ADCC sanctioned competition down into Tassie. Nice. Awesome. So I think that would be great, and just would be another, you know, another way to help develop it down here. You know, all I want to do is just see, you know, Tasmanian jiu-jitsu, just reach its potential, like every other coach down here, you know.
Yeah.
But that's certainly one of the things I'd like to see happen next.
And right. Damas, you're an accountant by profession?
Yes, yeah, I am. Yeah, absolutely.
Taxation department. Like, do you think that it sounds like you're quite systematic and quite logical in your thought process. Do you think that's helped your learning of jiu-jitsu, the way that you've taken it up?
Yeah, I think it has. Absolutely. Yeah, it has. I've always had a fairly analytical approach to it. I like to practice, but I also like to spend time thinking about practice as well. And I think that's really important. I don't see, like, these days I teach jiu-jitsu as, like, my coach, I should say, you know, full time, but I spend a lot of my time when I'm not on the mat thinking about how I can bring a better, you know, coaching experience and learning experience to the people that I share a mat with every week. That's a big part of it. And as well as, you know, fostering the young kids as well, because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. You know, I'm really big on the juniors. Yeah. I've got some young, you know, talented young people coming through down here. And that's another reason why too, I think, focusing on trying to build a competition experiences down here in Tasmania is huge. So, you know, we can ultimately, the next generation can take it and really run with it, you know. And not always have the need to travel out of state to do that.
That's brilliant. Yeah. With the self-defense aspect of jiu-jitsu, because you kind of came up in an era where it was very linked to, you know, a proving ground for against other martial arts. Do you like, have you, has it always been about the martial art itself for you, or was there a self-defense aspect? Was it, did you have to use it? Were you a street fighter? Were you into that sort of scene?
No,
collect debts in your accounting practice?
nothing like that. No, far less, unfortunately, far less glamorous than all that. But no, it was very much, really, I just loved it for what it was. But there was, you know, early on, I think there was a reasonable emphasis on the self-defense side of things. You know, knowing how to, you know, get out of, you know, key things, key holes. And I mean, you know, it's an interesting argument, the whole self-defense thing. But I mean, I think it has to be there. I think it, you know, ultimately, it's a great sport, but, you know, it needs to have a balanced approach. You know, I think, you know, ultimately, because not everyone's goal is to be a competitor. Some people just want the confidence of being able to know that, you know, they have a skill set there that is real, that it's built on, you know, real training and it works under resistance.
Nice.
And what do you think about, like, the changes? How can you talk at all about the landscape, how it's changed from, like, the late 90s to now in Australia? What do you see? What are the main standouts for you?
Well, I think in terms of how it's changed, I just think generally it's ultimately really it's the growth. It's the growth of the sport that has changed significantly. It's amazing now that I just had someone recently at my academy took a trip, you know, all the way up to the Sunshine Coast and drove all the way, and they took an inland route, went through Dubbo and places like that. And they said, you know, everywhere where I stopped, there was a place to train jiu-jitsu. And I thought that's, you know, that's fascinating, because once upon a time, as I say, when I started, there were two brown belts and they were both in Victoria. And, you know, and now it's one of these things that's just so widely practiced and so well accepted. And I think when you take that, of course, and you know, you roll that in with all the content and that is available, you know, online now, it's really seen it blossom, I think, in this country. You know, and then you've got some of those standout guys. I mean, early on there was very early on when I was coming through, there was Luke Picklum and you know, Daniel Cherubin, Anthony Parosh, Elvis Sinisic. It was all of these you know, guys that were blazing trails in their own way in terms of the competition scene. And yeah, these days, and those guys too, I would say, you know, they often brought quite a strong pressure game to the competition mats. Like they were heavy. The matches weren't necessarily fast and high paced. They were slow, grind out type matches, you know. And it was excellent, you know. And of course, you know, the leg lock revolution, I think's changed a lot. You know, I went back and I had quite a hiatus from competition, and I did a competition back in 2017, and the leg locks were just, you know, next level. Wrong, and just so systematic, you know, and in no short time, you know, that's revolutionized so much.
Absolutely.
But I think now moving forward, I think a lot of it is going to be in the wrestling space. You know, there's so many people doing wonderful things on or with that, and particularly under rules like ADCC. I think that's going to be possibly the next real frontier for development of the art. Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. Quick shout out to Vince Perry. You reminded me as you were reeling off OGs. He's announced his retirement from full time, you know, coaching and teaching. He's been around forever and a day as well. Actually, one of my first coaches ever. So yeah, really. Yeah, but man. I'd love to get
we
him
should
on the
get him on as well. Yeah,
we should get him on as
well.
The OGs. Yeah,
but you also sorry, go on.
No, I was just going to say, I did actually train with Vince once or twice very early on, probably in the late 90s or so. But yeah, Vince was always a very, very good coach, very accomplished, always has been. And another guy, he very much I would almost put into that same category as John, very structured in his training. And he's always been very, very accomplished.
Absolutely. But my question, I wanted to do a shout out to him. My question for you, and you raised it because there's gyms everywhere. You could go train everywhere. This is a completely hypothetical question. No right and wrong answers. And we've only got 3 minutes left. But do you think if you trained never at the same gym twice and just went around training everywhere, your jiu-jitsu would be better than if you only trained at one place all the time? Like, there is no right or wrong. It just got me thinking, like, if you dedicated your life to just training everywhere, what do you think that impact would, how do you think that would impact the game?
I think it would be, provided you had a mindset that was analytical, you could step away after each of those experiences and you know, objectively look at what, you know, you because every time you step on the mat, you should be able to garner some sort of experience from it. So if you had an objective and analytical way to do that, I think that would be a brilliant way to do it. It would give you a lot of exposure to a lot of different ways to do it. I mean, there's no one right way to coach jiu-jitsu. You know, for every 100 coaches out there, there's 100 different approaches in a lot of ways. You know, everyone does things slightly differently. So I think that would be a great way to certainly have a broad exposure to everything. And if you could, if you were an analytical person, I think you would get a hell of a lot out of coming at the game that way, for sure.
We've got just over a minute and a half to go, Dennis. Do you have any final words? You've given us lots of great info here. I think the viewers and the listeners will love this one. But any parting thoughts?
Look, really, I'm just excited to see what the future holds. You know, in for the art in this country anyway, I think, you know, the last few years or last 4 or 5 years in particular, you know, it's seen, you know, probably most well-known, two of the most well-known guys now to really make an impact on the scene has been Frey Jones and Lachlan Giles. And really, I was just at ADCC in Sydney on the weekend and just got back this morning. And, you know, I saw, you know, some pro divisions up there and my God, there is some emerging talent in this country. You know, that was a really, really stark example of that to me. I had the, you know, good fortune to be able to sit and watch many matches as well as being able to referee and so I'm just excited for the future. I think there's a lot of guys really, and women, I shouldn't say, yeah, so when I say, I mean, there is men, women, there is just so many good people out there now.
It's men, women, and children. The children are freaks of nature these days. Wow. We're out of time. We are out of time, guys. Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on.
Worries.
Amazing.
No worries. No worries. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
No worries. Thank you. Thank you. Cheers. Bye now.
Bye-bye.